No one's quite sure yet how Montana's new healthcare foundation plans to spend $40 million. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you how this cold snap may affect bark beetles. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with University of Montana forestry professor Martin Nye about the revival of the Sagebrush Rebellion. Attorney General Tim Fox is looking through a list of nominees for the board of a new state health foundation. The Montana Healthcare Foundation was established following the sale of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana to an out-of-state company. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the board will need to decide what to do with a $40 million trust.
Blue Cross Blue Shield sold to Illinois-based Healthcare Service Corporation this summer. State law says the proceeds from the sale of a nonprofit like Blue Cross must go toward a nonprofit foundation with a similar mission as the original company. In this case, the newly formed Montana Healthcare Foundation must pursue the broad goal of improving healthcare in the state. That's as specific as it gets at this point, though. It will be up to the Board of Trustees to figure out exactly what that means. A selection committee has been looking through 100 applications for months, narrowing to 7 nominees for the board. Interim trustee Ed Eck says the law requires candidates to come from geographically diverse parts of the state and to have varied backgrounds in areas like nonprofit management and investing.
We just tried to put together a team of people that we felt met those statutory requirements and were well regarded in their communities as civic leaders.
The nominees Eck and the selection committee put together include Director of the Center for Interdisciplinary Education at MSU Billings, Paul Cook, Associate Professor of Management at the University of Montana School of Business, Michael Harrington, Administrator of the Richland County Health Department, Judith LePan, retired Senior Vice President of New York Life Insurance Company, Joanna Piper, former Health Program Director at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, Dennis Prager, owner of Underwriter Moners, William Underwriter, and former Montana State Senator Mignon Waterman. Waterman says the trust provides a great opportunity for Montana, but the board will need to be very deliberate and responsible in finding ways to use it.
We could spend all of this money in a heartbeat. There is going to be a lot of requests, a lot of pressure on us to make decisions that people believe are very important to them and are very important to them.
Nominee Dennis Prager left the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation nearly 30 years ago to begin a consulting business in basically exactly this kind of work. He says he's worked for a dozen or more of these types of health foundations in a number of states. He says they've addressed very different kinds of things depending on the health needs of their state. The money could be used for stuff as varied as an immunization program for kids or starting a health policy center to help the state legislature. Prager says the board will first need to start listening.
Get some experts in to talk to us about what the problems really are. Each of us will come in with a particular bias, but what we need to do, we need data, we need evidence.
The nominees still need to be confirmed. Attorney General Tim Fox says he will be doing so in the next couple of weeks if all candidates meet the requirements of the law and complete background checks. Interim trustee Ed Eck also says the foundation could eventually receive another $100 million or more as additional Blue Cross assets are sold off. That's on top of the $40 million the foundation already has. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, Stillwater Mining Company says a 45-year-old worker has died from unknown causes after being found unconscious at the company's precious metals mine near Nye. The Billings-based company released a short statement today identifying the victim as Mike Rood, who had worked for Stillwater since 2007. The company says Rood was found unconscious and underground late last night and could not be resuscitated by the first responders. Regulators from the Mine Safety and Health Administration were at the mine today. Further details are not immediately available.
A 48-year-old northwestern Montana man who accidentally shot a Colorado hunter in the leg last month is charged with negligent endangerment. Mike Wagner of Libby made an initial appearance yesterday in justice court in Lincoln County. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has also cited Wagner with two more misdemeanors for hunting from a public highway and failure to obtain landowner permission before following a wounded mule deer buck onto private property on November 16th. The shooting victim, 60-year-old John Cleveland, was struck in the thigh. He was treated in Montana before returning to Colorado, where he remains hospitalized in critical but stable condition. He faces several operations to repair the damage to his leg. Cleveland was not wearing Hunter Orange when he was shot. FWP says he will not be charged.
Teachers are taking their argument against pension cuts to court in an effort to preserve inflationary increases. The lawsuit was filed by the Montana Teachers Union and six retired and current employees. The plaintiffs told a state judge today that cost-saving cuts to their pension payments are an unconstitutional change to the contract. The retirees warned lawmakers earlier this year that they would oppose any reduction in their guaranteed inflation increases of 1.5%. State lawmakers put those increases in place in 1999. The overhaul measure reduces the inflationary increase to 0.5% starting in January. Other changes not being challenged increase contributions from both employers and employees. The state argues the changes were necessary and that employment benefits are constantly changing.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has appointed former Montana State Senator Kim Gillen to lead a six-state region. The Billings Democrat will be HHS's director of Region 8, which includes Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says Gillen was chosen because of her experience in public service and her involvement in health-related policy initiatives. Gillen said today she will be based in Denver and will begin her new duties next month. The 61-year-old Gillen served 16 years in the Montana legislature. She lost to Republican Steve Daines in the 2012 election for Montana's only U.S. House seat. She was previously an energy analyst and business consultant and helped devise training programs to prepare women prisoners to re-enter the workforce.
A University of Montana professor of forest entomology and pathology says this prolonged and uncomfortable deep freeze probably won't be enough to kill mountain pine beetles. The rice grain-sized beetles are a native species that mass attack trees. UM College of Forestry and Conservation's Dr. Diana Six says hundreds or thousands of the insects can swarm a single tree, leaving it defenseless and essentially doomed. Mountain pine beetle populations surged in recent years and have had devastating impacts, leaving a red swath of dead and dying forest from Canada almost to Mexico.
It's kind of running its course in a lot of places, but they've already killed a lot of trees. In Montana, along some areas, they're still expanding. So if you go to the Big Hole or the Bitterroot, some of those areas, they're still on the increase in those spots.
The pine beetle population has thrived in part during several consecutive years of relatively warm temperatures. It takes very cold temperatures to kill the bugs. It's very cold right now and going to get even colder, but Six says it's just not enough.
It has to be really cold, although it depends on the time of year. So if these kind of temperatures had happened, you know, in October, they'd been dead because they wouldn't have had time to prepare. But right now they've produced antifreeze, and they can take temperatures to minus 30. They actually produce sort of a glycerol, something that keeps their liquids in their bodies from freezing. And so when they get ready for winter, they produce this compound, and it takes a very cold temperature to actually freeze them.
Six says this cold snap may kill some of the cleverly engineered insects in various pockets, but she's not expecting a widespread impact.
Montana Department of Transportation officials are considering an application from an Oregon company to move an oversized load of refinery equipment through the state to an oil sands project in Alberta. Omega Morgan began this week moving the water purification equipment from the port of Umatilla in Oregon. With the transport vehicles, the unit is almost 380 feet long and weighs more than 900,000 pounds. The load is 19 feet high and 22 feet wide. Motor Carrier Services Administrator Dwayne Williams tells the Missoulian he doesn't see anything alarming in the application. A court order in Idaho diverted the route away from the northern part of the state. The equipment will instead travel through eastern Oregon, across central Idaho, and into Montana over Lost Trail Pass.
Regulators say a Texas company has completed a cleanup of 714,000-gallon saltwater spill on the Montana-North Dakota border. Plano, Texas-based Denbury Onshore reported the spill from a 4-inch plastic pipeline in southeast Montana Monday the 25th. The North Dakota Health Department says the briny water reached the Big Gumbo Creek near Marmoth in southwest North Dakota. Salt water is a byproduct of oil production. North Dakota Water Quality Director Dennis Fulis says the salty water did not reach the Little Missouri River. Regulators in both states say the company used huge vacuums to suck up the salty water. They say the affected area then was flushed with fresh water.
Police in Helena say a woman who reportedly left her one-year-old child in a shopping cart after being confronted about shoplifting at Walmart was arrested when she returned to the store with the stolen items and to retrieve her child. Police Chief Troy McGee tells the Independent Record that 20-year-old Seneca Jensen was at Walmart with two other people at about 4:30 p.m. Monday and tried to leave without paying for about $44 in makeup and clothing. McGee says when they were confronted by store security, the adults ran to a vehicle and drove off. Jensen returned a short time later with the merchandise and left with her child. Police stopped her vehicle a short distance away. Jensen was cited for shoplifting and endangered the welfare of a child.
A Montana State University football player has denied a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge stemming from a fight outside a Bozeman bar. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports 22-year-old Jonathan Ellis II appeared in Bozeman Municipal Court today to enter a not guilty plea. Ellis was arrested on November 23rd after police said Ellis punched a man who hit his girlfriend. Two Butte men were also arrested. Michael Christopher Simmons pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct and was fined $100, while Riley James Masters has pleaded not guilty to the misdemeanor charge. Police said Simmons tried to punch Ellis but missed, hitting Ellis' girlfriend instead. Officers said Ellis then punched Simmons, and Masters was challenging Ellis when police arrived.
The movement to get the federal government to turn over its land to state and local governments is resurfacing in the American West. Led by a Utah-based group called the American Lands Council, supporters argue there is a legal and historical basis for this turnover. The movement resembles the so-called Sagebrush Rebellion of the late 70s. In this feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with University of Montana forestry professor and natural resource policy expert Martin Nye about both the old and new sagebrush rebels. Nye says the rebellion in the 70s was in direct response to the passage of several new environmental laws.
The Endangered Species Act, Federal Lands Policy Management Act,
National Environmental Policy Act,
NEPA. So there were a host of environmental laws. And of course, because so much of the West is owned by the federal government, federal lands management has always been a very salient issue in the West.
As you said, the initial Sagebrush Rebellion really was in part reaction to the environmental movement. That is because management of public lands did radically change after that movement.
That is true. There were new planning processes put into place, new environmental regulations. And then another important part of that story is that in 1976, Congress passed the Federal Lands Policy Management Act, which is known as FLIPMA. And that law, or what preceded that law, was a prolonged national debate and study commission looking at the role of public lands in the United States. And this study then finds its way into FLIPMA in 1976. And this law begins by basically saying that federal lands will be retained in public ownership. Congress essentially making the decision that this period of land disposal has come to an end and the federal lands will be retained in federal ownership. And that event, combined with an important Supreme Court decision in 1976, looking at the Constitution's Property Clause, those two events served as catalysts for this Sagebrush Rebellion. So I think it goes well beyond laws like NEPA and the Endangered Species Act. There was much more at play there. And like now, you know, back then, politics was really a driving factor. You know, the sagebrush litigation of the late 1970s was not successful, but in a way that rebellion, there was a political symbolism associated with that rebellion. And I think that's very much the case today as well.
And a good part of this has to do not just with the management of public lands, but the whole attitude of the federal government is never going to be as responsive and as democratic as local government, that the federal government is in some ways the enemy.
Well, the new Sagebrush Rebels make a number of interesting arguments, and I think that they're almost all of them are built on a pretty shaky legal, constitutional, economic foundation.
Shaky how?
Well, you know, the courts have dealt with this issue about federal land ownership, and it's been resolved. In favor of the federal government. The U.S. Constitution is very clear regarding Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, the so-called property clause that gives Congress the power to dispose of or make all needful rules and regulations pertaining to federal lands. It gives Congress that power, not the state legislatures.
In terms of what is likely to happen in the future, it does seem like these efforts to regain control of federal lands by states or local governments are a waste of time or not?
Well, I would correct you. It's not regain, because those states never owned that property to begin with. So what this really is a transfer. And if you look at the Utah's bill, for example, this Utah, I think it's called the Transfer of Lands Act. It seeks to extinguish title, federal lands title, and basically transfer that title to the state of Utah. There's no transferring back to the state of Utah because Utah never owned those lands to begin with. And yes, I do believe it's a waste of time. And I find it incredibly frustrating as well, you know, that there are... If you think about the conservation issues of this century, from fire and fish and wildlife issues, you name it, it requires the constructive engagement of the federal and state governments working in a cooperative fashion.
Not to mention a ton of money.
And a ton of money. And, you know, we have seen, and at the same time, there are dozens of collaborative groups and other initiatives in the western states that are really doing practical problem solving in the West, trying to resolve a number of intractable issues. Consider the Blackfoot Challenge, for example, and all of the success in the Blackfoot, where you have multiple partners, federal, state, private, working together for the greater good. That's the sort of cooperation and constructive engagement that's necessary in moving forward. So, yeah, I find it incredibly frustrating that we're hearing the same recycled arguments that have really no merit whatsoever.
Even though people who are advocating this won't succeed, do they succeed in other ways in terms of eroding public trust of federal government? Do they succeed in ways that are harmful to land management?
I think so. I mean, it makes for great political theater, and that's what this is. It's a useful political wedge issue in some legislative districts. But again,
it
certainly helps campaigns. It's easy to pick on the federal government and mismanagement, and there's certainly lots of issues pertaining to federal land management, serious issues. And there are a lot of people trying to solve those problems in a serious way. But transferring federal lands to the states is in no way solving these problems.
In terms of public attitudes in general across the country, there's poll after poll showing support for public land ownership, meaning federal land ownership, that the public wants there to be national parks and national forests and wildlife refuges.
That's correct.
So you have to wonder where the sympathy for the new Sagebrush Rebellion really lies.
You know, I would put this in its appropriate political context, where we have right now in the U.S. Congress and outside of D.C. the most hyper-polarized U.S. Congress in 100 years. And the political science literature consistently shows this incredible pulling apart of the parties and this hyper-polarization. And we're seeing it in Congress that there are dozens of bills moving through the House of Representatives right now that would fundamentally eviscerate several foundational environmental laws. And we're seeing the same sort of polarization outside of D.C., especially with those most engaged in politics, political activists. So I think it's important to view what's happening right now in that larger political context. It's incredible polarization in the United States. And I think these bills coming out of the various state legislatures are another manifestation of this hyper-polarization. Just like the Sagebrush Rebellion of the late 70s, the symbolic value was important. And also you have to keep in mind, one of the goals of these various bills is to start for these critics of federal lands, the new Sagebrush Rebels, to get on the offense, right? To introduce a number of bills and resolutions and to pass laws critical of or seeking the transfer of federal lands, which basically puts those voices on the offense and forces conservationists and federal land agencies and others to play more defense. So I think there's a political tactic involved there as well.
Well, it's an interesting resurgence of that movement, and one we'll be discussing further, I'm sure. I have been speaking with University of Montana Forestry Professor Martin Nye. Professor Nye, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Martin Nye will give a free public lecture on the new Sagebrush Rebellion Monday evening at 6:30 in the Community Center at the Hamilton City Hall. His talk precedes another talk by the president of the American Lands Council, Ken Ivory. Ivory's talk begins at 6:30 next Wednesday evening at the Eagles Club in Hamilton.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a wind chill watch in effect from tomorrow afternoon through Saturday morning for the entire west of the Divide. Now, tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows 12 below to 19 below zero. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 6 to 13 degrees. For central Montana, there is a wind chill advisory in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for Blaine and Fergus counties. There is also a wind chill advisory in effect until 8 p.m. this evening for the northern Rocky Mountain Front, eastern Glacier, Hill, Toole, Liberty, Eastern Pendere, and Judith Basin counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 15 below to 25 below zero. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and highs 5 below zero to zero. For southwest Montana, there is a wind chill advisory in effect until 8 p.m. this evening for Beaverhead and Madison counties, and tonight expect partly cloudy skies and lows 10 below to 20 below zero. Tomorrow should have increasing cloud cover and highs 0 to 5 above. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
We've seen the fateful video many times. Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. You see the turning of his head, a wave of the hand, that big smile erupting under bright eyes, and that broad shock of hair parted right to left. In that moment, he doesn't know that it is the last time he will ever smile. And that unknowing in that smiling moment of what will happen next is haunting. It looms over the unfolding scene like an angel of death. And as we watch the film again, we wish we could just yell out, tell him to duck. We wish we could go back in time and do something to make that next horrible moment not happen. But we can't. The assassination of John F. Kennedy, for many, meant the end of idealism for our country. It meant that even the young and powerful were vulnerable. It meant Jackie losing a husband. But perhaps most powerfully for those of us who had no connection to the Kennedys, the scene depicted in that primitive film was a reminder of death itself, the transition from the vitality of life to its irreversible loss. Most of us have faced that reality much more personally. A loved one who smiles at one moment is gone the next. The irreducible power of the life of a person and their utter irreplaceability. It strikes me that a central moral challenge for humanity is revealed in something called the collapse of compassion. It is the inability to sense, with anything close to that same power, the tragedy of the deaths of groups of human beings with whom we have no connection. The roughly 11,000 Americans who have died from gun violence since last year's Newtown shooting, or the 45,000 Americans who die each year from lack of health care. We don't feel the reality of their deaths in our guts the same way. But they, like Kennedy, are individuals too. Columnist Nicholas Kristof writes of a truck driver named Richard Streeter, who, for lack of affordable health insurance, put off visiting his doctor until it was too late to treat what he discovered was advanced colon cancer. Unlike watching the Kennedy assassination, we can only imagine the look on Mr. Streeter's face the moment just before his doctor told him he had a disease that would likely kill him, as well as the moment just after. We don't see images of him with his family. To many, he is a member of that impersonal mass of people whose death moves us not. During the time you've listened to this commentary, 15 people like Mr. Streeter will have died for lack of health care. For each one of these victims, each and every single one, the irreducible power of the life of a person is likewise gone irreversibly. So why are we not just clamoring, Republicans and Democrats alike, to rescue and improve the Affordable Care Act, end gun violence, or eliminate poverty, rather than let one more person suffer the same death? Why is there a collapse of compassion? One big reason is this. Research shows that compassion for groups collapses when we are actually expected to help many people, like through donations. We restrain our emotional responses to the tragedy of many when we consider how helping them might adversely affect us. Instead, if we first choose to desire to help, compassion may follow. That's why we need to address issues like healthcare through the powerful feelings evoked when we consider what is at stake for those like Mr. Streeter. Then we need to do something, like contacting our congressman, make that next horrible moment not happen for someone else, or for ourselves. The irony is that Kennedy represented a hopeful idealism for so many people. The idea that America had passed a torch to a new generation to sacrifice and serve for a greater good. The idea that justice meant rights for all, and not just for the white and wealthy. His death inspired many to work for a stronger social safety net. Many now try to kill this idealism with words like costs, taxes, socialism, all aimed at winning political victories while collapsing your compassion for those who will die. So now, as the commemoration of Kennedy's death fades, as the days grow dark and the cold of winter encroaches, we enter a season in which many of us believe that when darkness is longest, new light is born again. In that conviction, perhaps we can once again grasp the reality that the death of many unknown to us is as much of a tragedy to prevent as the death of a man who tried to help us see that. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.